thanks very much for joining me. I'm Bob Franklin. You're listening to the Radio Public Affairs program, Like It Is.
Thank you, Bob. On this edition of Like It Is, we're speaking with Velma Valoria. She's a very accomplished lady. She was the first Filipino-American state legislator in the country, and she served for many years. And now she is a co-organizer of a very interesting international conference on human trafficking. It'll be at the University of Washington. It's called Human Trafficking in an Era of Globalization, Forced Labor, Involuntary Servitude, and Corporate and Civic Responsibility. Welcome, Velma. First question is, what exactly is human trafficking? Because I know people probably think of sexual trafficking first, but it's more than that.
Yes, so the definition is that human trafficking is somebody who's brought or who is forced to do something, not get reimbursed for their labor.
You've been interested in this issue for a really long time, and you were a pioneer. I remember back when you were in the state legislature, you passed the first resolution on this, I think, in the nation. Tell me a little bit about how you got started in all of this.
So it wasn't a resolution, but an actual piece of legislation to make human trafficking a crime in the state level. How I got started into it really has a lot to do with what happened with three Filipino women who were murdered at the King County Courthouse. One of them was a mail order bride. What we did was we took a look at the issue of mail order brides. Why was this happening? It wasn't just one incident. It was a series of incidences that happened in the state of Washington. There was a woman from Kyrgyzstan who was found murdered, 20 years old. She was found murdered in her husband's, a shallow grave in her husband's home. She was only 20 years old, and she was a student here at the University of Washington. The husband was reportedly thinking about getting another third mail order bride. This woman from Kyrgyzstan was his second.
How large of a problem is human trafficking? I think it's probably hard to estimate or even know, since it is really hidden. But I just want a kind of a sense of how widespread it is and if it's a growing problem.
It's a global issue. It's not just an issue of here in Washington State. It's an issue worldwide. So that's why we're calling this an international conference, right? But what's happening is that we're thinking it is growing. It's like the second largest underground industry in the world, second only to guns and drugs. And part of the reason we think it's happening has a lot to do with different types of policies, in particular the international trade agreements. As we move to push for the cheapest rate of labor, I think that there's a lot of people that have lost their jobs. There's a lot of people that are suffering. And in order to try to get out of that suffering, they become vulnerable and fall prey to human trafficking.
Can you give me some examples of how this might be happening?
Basically, what happens in farming is that presumably the United States says that if you are working in the United States, you have to have legal permission to do so. So they go through a social security number and they call it E-Verify. And what happens is when the Immigration and Naturalization Service ask a farmer to verify the social security numbers of their employees, many people begin to scatter. The workers scatter. some of them know that they don't have legal status in the United States. But they're not also going to go back to where they come from because they know that they're not going to be able to find a job there. So what happens is they go underground. And then when you go underground, you become vulnerable. So in the agricultural industry, there's this thing called coyotes. And these coyotes are the people that recruit workers. And they recruit them to work in other farms. And most of the time, the coyotes take advantage of those workers.
People might be surprised to find out that this is happening in their own backyard. I was kind of surprised when I think about all the agricultural workers here in Washington State. Is it really that prevalent? I mean, it's could be any state, any city.
It could be any state, any city, anywhere in the world. One of the things that we're looking at is this whole issue regarding the Philippines, right? So the Philippines has an office, an actual office of Overseas Filipino Workers, OFW. They have 8 million Filipino workers around the world. And many of those workers are brought to other countries, and we don't know what happens to them. In our example, in our own state, there was need for agricultural workers. And there was a recruiter that went to recruit workers from Thailand. They paid the people from Thailand paid these recruiters money to come to the United States, promising them jobs here in the U.S., and then only to get into a situation where they are working but are not being paid, and actually got stranded in Washington State. And so we needed to try to figure out how to deal with that situation. So we will have people from the Department of Labor and Industries here in the state to address those types of questions. Because in the state, Washington State has one out of every five jobs related to trade. We are one of the most trade-dependent states in the nation. We also have one of the highest minimum wage. And we want to make sure that, you know, employees are getting the minimum wage. So it means checking on employers to make sure that they're paying that minimum wage. And when some of them can't come up with that, then they get penalized. So that's one of the things that we're trying to do. We are working with the Department of Labor and Industries, as well as the Department of Commerce, to try to figure out some solutions. I know, for example, with the issue of the medical industry, we're helping to develop a protocol for the victims in terms of the agricultural industry. We're trying to help educate the broader public about what it means if the workers, the agricultural workers, become vulnerable and have to be underground.
Is this the first conference of this size and scope?
This is our second conference. The first one was just to introduce the issue of human trafficking, and that was in 2001. We did a lot of organizing in between, and like I said, human trafficking has become synonymous with sex trafficking, and while that some of that is happening, we also feel that the majority of the people that are being trafficked are in labor trafficking. So we want to be able to say, look, there's more to this human trafficking than just sex. You need to take a look at other sectors of society, and that's forced labor.
What are some highlights of the conference that you're going to cover?
We have already established that human trafficking occurs, right? But what we want to also do is to, number one, highlight the fact that it's not just about sex, it's about different types of labor. So we have people from the hotel industry coming. We have people from the agricultural industry talking about how their workers can become vulnerable. We also, one of the highlights is this woman, because in Washington State, the human trafficking movement began through the mail order bride issue. We wanted to bring somebody from the Philippines who's familiar with the state of the Filipino woman in the Philippines to see what type of progress has been made in helping women become more stabilized in the Philippines. And that's one highlight. The other highlight is making the link between human trafficking and public policy issues. Number one is this whole issue of our international trade agreements. Can we have, instead of a race to the bottom, can we have a worker situation where they don't have to go to the race of the bottom, but there should be some sort of a standard similar to what we have in Washington State, where our minimum wage is at $9 and some odd cents an hour. There should be a global standard for how much it would cost to survive and be paid that kind of hourly wage. So those are some of the things that we're looking at. Again, the thing about the that's unique to this conference is we will have people who are survivors of human trafficking talk about what they went through, make suggestions about what they want to happen. And then finally, this whole issue of the healthcare protocol. You have a lot of people that are undergoing sex trafficking, but yet there's no one addressing the issue of then how do you deal with all these sexually transmitted diseases that happen with human trafficking? How do you deal with the post-traumatic syndrome with all these, you know, victims of human trafficking? So that, I hope, is what we hope to gain. We're expecting about 250 people to come, which is what we think it's a pretty big conference. And then hopefully some real good discussions to come out of it. And solutions.
So we're speaking to Velma Valoria. She is one of the organizers of the Human Trafficking International Conference at the University of Washington. You spoke a little bit about the agricultural industry, and that was pretty insightful in explaining to me how that might happen. You mentioned other industries like construction. And
the issue of individuals becoming actual traffickers. Remember when I told you about a man who was bringing in another woman to be his bride, and in reality she was to become their domestic helper? Those are individual traffickers, and it's happening within the family. So I think those are some of the things that are unseen and not talked about. And those are things that I hope that people can get out of it, that there needs to be more of a critical eye in looking at, you know, these possible scenarios.
I'm looking at some of the speakers, and I'm really quite impressed with the types of people that are going to be speaking at this conference. They're officials from all over and at all levels. And I'm wondering if maybe you might be able to summarize some of the people that are concerned about this problem and able to address the conference.
Well, like I said, the issue of human trafficking is a global issue. So it involves businesses. We've got businesses on these panels. We have Starbucks, for example, coming in. We've got the labor movement, the organized labor movement. So we have somebody from the International Solidarity Center who has seen it on a worldwide scale. We have somebody, our speaker, I think, on Saturday, is someone who has worked with people from Haiti. And you know what happened in Haiti when they had the big tsunami, the earthquake, and then how some people have taken advantage of that situation and actually recruited from the camps of those victims to get their kids to be sold to human trafficking. So it's worldwide, it's international, and it takes many different forms. So it's not just an issue of, you know, forced labor from a perspective of, you know, somebody making you work, but also forced labor because you've got no place else to go. So parents sell their kids because they can't afford to keep them, to keep feeding them, to care for them. And that's what happened, I think, in Haiti. And then what's our international policy doing to help? Is it helping or is it hurting? Those are some of the discussions that's going to be happening here. And I think it's a great discussion.
So you were talking about some of the parents that sell their children, and as a parent, I think it's pretty surprising that occurs. How does that typically happen? Do the people come in and then promise that the children will be taken care, you know, well taken care of? Is that typically what happens?
You know, it would be great if we could interview the woman from Haiti, but in summation, basically what happened was there was a natural disaster in Haiti. People did not have permanent homes. They were placed in campsites. And in these campsites, people still could not afford to feed, you know, their young people. So what happens is when you don't have the money to feed your young, somebody will come and say, hey, you know, we'll take care of them. We will, you know, send them and, you know, have them get a good education. We will feed them. So of course, you know, take the child off my hands because I can't afford to do that. But in reality, what happens then is the child becomes a victim of human trafficking.
I know there was an incident recently in Seattle where the mayor became very concerned about this problem because there's a very popular magazine or a weekly that was helping create this problem. It's something that a magazine that everybody around here reads, and to me, it's an example of what can happen right in front of you, right beneath your nose.
So our mayor in Seattle was concerned that underage young ladies were being prostituted through an organization, and it was called Backpage.com, right? Basically, that Backpage.com was putting out articles or putting out visuals about women and their sexual activities. What the mayor was concerned about was that many of those women were underage, under 18. So we put forward a piece of legislation. Senator Jeannie Caldwell-Wells actually put forward a piece of legislation to stop that from happening. And do you know what? It was challenged by the court as a First Amendment right of the newspaper. So that piece of legislation may have to be rescinded. What our worry is, if you use the First Amendment rights all the time, then, you know, where do we go? Is there a way that we can address it and still be sensitive to the First Amendment rights?
Any final thoughts?
Well, final thoughts is, first of all, this is not just about sex trafficking. It's all forms of human trafficking. I've even heard of cases that traffic kidneys. You know how, like, people have two kidneys? You can survive with one. So people pay, you know, money for you to donate your other kidney. So, I mean, that's one, right? We don't cover that here. But the other part is, like I said, all forms of human trafficking. And then the parting last word, like I said, is that this is the second largest growing industry, criminal industry in the world. The second largest in the world. So it's very prominent, and it's happening everywhere. So we'll have people who have seen the cases of Haiti. Dr. Sutapa Basu can talk to you about what she has seen in India. You know, we can talk about Kyrgyzstan and the woman who was, you know, a victim of human trafficking because she had to become a mail order bride. Many, many cases. So I just would like everybody to come to this conference. I think it's very educational, very powerful, and also it will provide some solutions to what we think we need to do. Like, for example, taking a look closer at those international trade agreements that, you know, our Congress automatically signs or approves. We need to be more vigilant about it. And we need to develop a health protocol for these victims. So that for us is really, how do you say, historical. Then the other thing that I wanted to tell you about is we also have people who have been victims of human trafficking coming to tell us their story. It should be a real good discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Velma Valoria, talking about the human trafficking problem and what you can do to recognize and help solve this issue. Now back to you, Bob.
I'm Makua Holt. Today on Like It Is, what are some of the early signs of autism in children? Janice Warren, parent, art educator, and advocate, is here to tell us more.
They're off to themselves, they're happy, and they don't want to be bothered. Those are some of the signs that a parent can look for. A red flag will probably go up. Those signs were always present for me. And again, I just wasn't aware. I just thought it was a stage. And I didn't know a lot about autism. You want to go to your pediatrician, you get a second opinion or a thought of where to go forward.
According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, autism is one of the fastest growing developmental disorders.
Thank you for joining us, Janice.
Hi, thank you for having me, Akua. Glad to be here.
The CDC says in 2023, 1 in 36 children
in the U.S. were estimated to have autism,
an increase from 1 in 44 children. Although exact cause of autism is still unknown, there's evidence to suggest that genetics may play a role since autism is less prevalent in females. Autism was always thought to be passed down from the mother. However, research suggests that autism genes are usually inherited from the father. The study also reported that art therapy may reduce social communicative issues and restrictive and repetitive behavior patterns. They found that the typical art therapy elements, sensory experiences with sight and touch, may improve behavior, flexibility, and attention abilities of children with ASD. This study was done in September 2023. As a parent of a child with autism, what can you share to help us understand what is autism and how it shows up in children? Were you aware of autism in the early stages of your child's development?
Because my previous teaching experience was in the early childhood setting. I worked with numerous daycares and early childhood centers throughout the city of Houston and surrounding areas for many years, learning about developmentally appropriate activities and how to help children meet their milestones, you know, making sure that not only in my daughters, but children that I worked with, I was always collecting data because we would always send home what we call daily reports. So I was just making sure that the students were right on task. My youngest daughter, who is now 16, it did come as a surprise because I was not aware of autism. There was not a lot of knowledge back then for me to truly understand what it was. I saw a lot of symptoms. I saw a lot of things that were not lining up. I noticed a lot of repetitive behaviors, but I was not aware of autism. It was not something that was introduced in the early childhood setting or in the classrooms that I frequent on a daily basis.
For parents who may be unfamiliar with autism, what are some of the patterns they may see in their children to identify early on that, yes, I should have my child screened for autism?
There are a lot of what we call just signs, such as hidden signs, repetitive behaviors. That's one thing that I would notice with my daughter. She would do a lot of repetition of, she would take little objects that she would find on the floor or in her room. She would line them up into straight lines, and they would be odd type of little gadgets. She didn't play with what we call traditional toys like blocks and puzzles and even Barbie dolls. She would find little screws or little pins or little paper clips and just play with those and gravitate to those and line them up. So that's one of the autism signs that you may want to look for. Again, repetitive behaviors, flapping of hands, twirling hands. A lot of the kids will lose eye contact when you're talking to them. Their eyes tend to wander off into space. They have a difficult time looking at you directly in your eyes. Repetitive movements, along with, I think I mentioned that, also echolalia. If they're not verbal, then echolalia, they would repeat some of the things that you say. Do you want a drink? Do you want a drink? Would you like a cookie? Would you like a cookie? So that repetitive behavior is present immediately. Those are just some of the signs that I would notice when she was very young. I'm an art educator as well as an art facilitator, and I consider myself to be also an advocate. I don't consider myself to be an art therapist, but what I do with my students is very therapeutic. I introduce them to techniques where they can slowly engage into discovering new materials. So it's very tactile. A lot of the materials are what I call adaptive materials, with some students who have a difficulty with gripping a paintbrush or gripping a pencil, then they have to use different materials, and they may have tape that can be wrapped around a paintbrush because of the fact it helps them to grip. They may not be comfortable with the smoothness of the brush. There's a lot of one-on-one that I do with my students. So everything is taken in a very slow process. Even when I am giving instructions, I give a lot of visual clues. For example, one, we're going to take out the paint. Two, I have an image for them to look at so that they will know what to expect, step one, step two, and step three. My work is fun and engaging so that they know that there aren't any wrongs to it. They're allowed to stand. And we use different parts of our bodies. Sometimes we'll use in our hands. We can paint with our feet. They use their fingers. And we use a lot of what we call non-traditional objects. For example, straws, cotton balls. We just use a little bit of everyday objects so that they can kind of connect with product and with the materials.
Someone asked this question, how can you prevent autism? Not sure. As you mentioned, early screening is very helpful. Some of the risks associated with autism that can be reduced: smoking, drinking, eating a well-balanced diet, staying away from airborne chemicals, secondhand smoke, and being very cautious when using chemicals that you clean with, and maintaining a very relaxed environment. Well, that's going to do it, Ms. Janice Warren.
Okay, well, thank you so much for having me.
Reporting from Houston, Texas, for Like It Is, I'm Akua Holt.
I'm Bob Franklin. I'll be back next week with 30 more minutes of good conversation on another edition of Like It Is.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.